You're listening to Thunder Quack Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cartoon Afternoon. I'm your host, Curtis Findlay.
I am your other host, Michael Cohen.
And with us today, we have a special treat for you. This is the creator of Darkwing Duck himself, Mr. Tad Stones.
Well, hello to you.
Welcome to the show, Tad. We are so excited to be able to talk with you, pick your brain about Darkwing Duck and maybe even the new DuckTales show. And just find out all about you, I guess.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So I've been browsing through the Wikipedia page, you know, the biography of your life.
And I should check that every once in a while.
Well,
you let us know if any of these facts are incorrect. But it says here that your first work with Disney Feature Animation was animating a scene in The Rescuers. Is that correct?
Well, that's a weird way to put it. I mean, the first thing that, you could see on screen would be a scene in The Rescuers, yeah. I started right out of college with the Disney training program, which was not the big fancy thing it turned into later. It was just sitting in a room next to Eric Larson, who was one of the 9 old men of Walt's day. You know, the guys who helped start the studio with Walt. Anyway, I came like 5 months after Ron Clements of Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Moana fame, and about 3 months or 2 months before Glenn Keane. So it was like Glenn came right after me. And then there's a gap, and then we got a bunch more guys. And then CalArts started up and brought in a lot of people. But anyway, you survived. You had to do personal tests, and if you survived those two review boards, which were made up of the rest of the veterans, then you became an in-betweener, hell on earth. So it was for me, because I was not good at it. I just conceptually did not get it until I was well into story. And then one day I went, oh, that's what they meant. Okay. Light bulb went off, not bright enough to make me want to go back to in-betweening. But
I think anyway, it takes a special person to.
Yeah, so I did, got the one scene done in The Rescuers, and then realized, because you got ahead by doing personal tests, and I I kept starting new ones, and the manager of the department came by one day, and I said, hey, Ed, because we had moviolas, because everything was on film back then, can you come in and take a look at this? And I said, I was thinking of going back in and finishing up this test, and I think it was one with Madame Mim and Merlin and sitting across from a table from each other, and magical stuff happens. Anyway, I showed it to him. He says, and he said, oh, you should show it as is. That's great. That looks really good. Pause. Yeah, we had kind of given up on you. No one thought to mention that to me. like maybe at a 6 months review or something. Anyway, I think that's when I made assistant animator. It was actually after that I did that rescuer scene. But I realized that what I was doing is I kept starting new personal tests because, oh, this is a better idea. And I realized that I rather create what the character is going to do than actually execute it. So it just seemed like the definition of story, and I moved into story. I did storyboards on, you know, in Fox and the Hound too, all uncredited, because this is before the days of everybody gets a credit. This was, the credits were, they probably had
a couple of slides of
credit, and that's about it, and about six names on each. And it was a different world, and you just accepted that. I went over to Imagineering, and I know I came back, and they said, well, you're not going to get credit, because it was basically up to the directors, and most of my work was done with Wooly Reitherman. Again, another one of the, quote, nine old men. But then it was taken over by other directors, so I hadn't worked with them, and so kind of out of sight, out of mind. And it didn't bother me until they gave a credit to Squeaks, the worm. So, because he was just a sound effect, and they thought it was cute that, you give him a name and a title, and it's like, it's just a little piece. It's like, it's lettering on a frame of film, and you gave it to an imaginary character instead of me, who had actually worked on the film and storyboarded sequences and all of that. But whatever, that was my first scene was in there. And I really enjoyed animation. My favorite part of the process is actually flipping the paper on the animation desk, because you literally are watching your drawings, if you're doing it right, come alive. That it is a magical thing, that suddenly the character is moving around and hopefully acting. But I moved into story after that.
Wow. And you worked with a bunch of the shows for the Disney Afternoon, like Gummy Bears, and
that was like 10 years later, but yeah.
Right.
I'm skipping ahead. I think the people, I know that I want to spend kind of the most of our time here talking about the Disney Afternoon for sure.
I went over to TV. I was one of the first people at TV Animation. I was at the first meeting at Michael Eisner's house about forming TV Animation. And that was interesting. And then I went back to features. I was actually considering leaving the company, and I thought, what if I could storyboard and make enough money storyboarding? In other words, when I say I storyboarded on Fox and Hounds, that's a different thing. You're kind of writing with pictures, as opposed to here I'm following a script and directing it on the page, because that's what television does. And I thought, if I could do that and make enough money, then I could, write science fiction short stories for my soul. And here I saw the guy who was Michael Webster, who was president, I think was his title, of TV Animation at the time. And I said, hey, Michael, do you guys do freelancers and all that? And he says, oh, I don't know if you want to do that. Why don't you come over and visit us? Why don't you come over this afternoon? And I had forgotten that ever since that first meeting, they wanted me as part of the group. It just wasn't directly put to me. Anyway, I ended up there. Technically, I started as an executive creative manager, which put me in charge of development. But then for developing shows, I was bad at it in that they expected me to work with outside writers and pitch their ideas to sell shows. And again, I was pretty ignorant. It was like, well, that's not fair. You're not paying for these people, and then you're going to take their ideas, pitch them, and, which is how the process works. Anyway, getting ready for a Gong show, it's like I came up with 8 times. I think we pitched 22 shows. I think 18 of them were mine, and the rest were probably all Jim Magons, who was, story editing on Gummy Bears full time. Anyway, third season of Gummies is when I moved into to take over Jim's spot. And then Jim went into DuckTales. In DuckTales, I was involved in the development and giving notes. And I would have sworn I've never story edited on DuckTales. And then I found some publicity materials where Len Yule did a Valentine special and goes on and on about how it was so great working with the story editor, Tad Stones. I said, there goes my brain. So I can say, yes, I did work on the original DuckTales. So, yeah, my first show on which before it was part of the Disney Afternoon was the third season of Gummy Bears. Mm. And then Rescue Rangers and Darkwing Duck. And then after that, I was assigned all the, you know, because of my feature background, the feature spinoffs like Aladdin and Hercules and Buzz Lightyear and Atlantis in the middle of that. Yeah.
Nice. Mike, do you have any questions? I don't want to ask all the questions.
No, I mean, like, my focus is definitely going to be when we get to Darkwing, because I have a lot of questions about that. Yeah? Okay, if we want to get into Darkwing now, unless, Curtis, you wanted to ask anything about Rescue Rangers before we did that?
We can talk about Darkwing.
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
So I Darkwing Duck is probably one of, like, my first three or four things that I was an obnoxious geek about. And if you talk to my parents,
you're a normal geek. Yeah.
Okay. If you talk to my parents, Darkwing Duck was one of those things that I was just obsessed with. And I have such a vivid memory of the night that it premiered. It was the first time I ever had pizza was that night.
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Big deal. Right.
Are you sure? Yeah. I love Darkwing. There was like a cheesy savoriness to it.
Yeah.
pepperoni for some reason.
I remember sitting around with my whole family, like I have two brothers and my mom and dad, and we were sitting in our TV room and watching this, and everybody enjoyed it. But I think, like, if you asked my parents, I was on another planet. I was somewhere else because I was just so over the moon with it. And so I had to have everything, right? I had to have everything Darkwing that we could get our hands on. And as a kid, it always bothered me so much. I had the bed sheets, and on the bed sheets, I think it was either on the top sheet or on the pillowcase, Darkwing was colored differently. Right. He was
that happened a lot of times where
he's purple and pink and turquoise everywhere else. Right. Or teal mm-hmm. everywhere else. And then on this, and I had a sticker book that matched it where he was gray and his hat was almost black and the inside of his cape was red.
I've seen it. I have those sheets. I don't remember that. So is that on the pillowcase or?
I think it was on
bedspread. I didn't have the bedspread.
Yeah, it was on something. I had it on a couple of things, and I remember it especially in the sticker book, and it bothered me because I'm such a stickler for consistency, and I was like, this isn't what he looks like in the show.
I'll tell you something about the bedsheet specifically. Yeah. I had a deal with licensing because they need your input on meetings, and usually you're super busy. But I told people on licensing is I will go to as many meetings as you want, as long as you give me one each of everything that's done. And pretty much they did that. There were a couple of things that slipped by that I got later.
That's the Mark Hamill trick. That was in his contract.
Lot of times, and it's a pet peeve of mine, but you know, it's just part of it is that they show you stuff, mm-hmm. but the pet peeve is don't show me stuff that it's too late to change.
Yeah.
Because then you're not really asking my opinion. You're just informing me, which is fine.
Yeah.
But you can just like send me a picture or something.
Yeah.
But on the bed sheets, they use Darkwing waking up out of bed.
Yeah.
Because they said, that's perfect. You know, it's right there in the first episode. And I said, if you're doing a Batman and Robin bed sheet, for many reasons, you don't put them in bed. You have them in an exciting pose running at you or hitting a crook or something like that. And it was one of those things where they kind of paused and it's like, mentally, I'm sure they're saying, oh, he kind of has a point, but we're not changing it.
So. We've already done all the work.
Yeah. So the other thing in licensing, they kind of used they wanted to do a comic book style, but they did this cross-hatching thing.
Yeah.
Because they had they had used a very much of a comic book style on all the Tailspin merchandise. And so they wanted each show to have a different look. And so they brought up, actually, I think they had some Shadow Comics by Mike Kaluta, I'm thinking, who has a very detailed crosshatch style. I mean, he's a gorgeous artist. Anyway, it was one of those things where that's why there's all that crosshatch. Mm-hmm. The style they chose, where to me it was, I'm sorry you use the comic book stuff on the other show, but it would really be good here. Yeah. There's many ways to do it, but I understood I'm not in control of their business. I understood that they had to do something different. Yeah. But it's just funny you brought up the sheets, because that there were two things, both the posing and then the cross-hatching that came up at the same time. I went, okay.
I always wondered about that cross-hatching.
Yeah.
Even as a little kid, I always wondered about that.
That was one of the things. So you answered one of the questions that I have already with that.
Well, another one that maybe I can get to. Everybody asks, why is Toscanini all over stuff? It's that... he was in the Bible. There were, you know, just characters you come up with, and it's like, okay, here's an example of the type of villain.
Yeah.
And there was Toscanini was in it, who got used, and Madame Animatronic was never used except in the background because nobody took to her. We didn't really put out a personality. Nobody came up with an idea. So she was just never used. But basically, that Bible gets handed around throughout the company, and they're just, you know, very few investigate to follow up saying, are there any other villains you have?
Yeah.
So that's why Toscanini's everywhere.
Wow.
So the coloring, when I talk about that gray and red color scheme, which is so different from what Darkwing actually looks like, it had put me on like a quest all throughout my life. Anytime I could find information about the development of Darkwing Duck, I'd be trying to figure out like, where did this random color scheme come from? And that led me eventually to the history of the character and 00 Duck and sort of the development process to get from 00 Duck to Darkwing. And I was just hoping that you could kind of talk about that.
Yeah, but the more important question is, did you find out how they messed up the colors on that sheet?
I think that...
It would be very ironic if you became the kind of collector who collects the upside-down stamps. Or with the misprints and things like that, so you only collect things with the wrong colors on them.
I mean, the best that I can figure is that it did come from some of the 00 Duck stuff, because I think there was a little bit more of like the James Bond color scheme there, right? He had more of like a white jacket, right?
He had a white tuxedo jacket, bow tie. I think in some of the early things I might have painted him his cape black, but really, and it was red on the inside. But it was one of those things we wanted to make him more colorful, and that's why purple was used, basically. How it started is, some people think that it came from both 00 Duck and the Mask Mallard episode of DuckTales, and that's not true. It came from Jeffrey Katzenberg. In fact, okay. I'm not sure I've ever seen the Mask Mallard episode, but Jeffrey and Michael both were suckers for catchy titles because they counted on you to create a great show that would hold an audience. But if you had an interesting title that they felt like, you might get a bigger audience to sample your show, and then your great writing and creativity would keep that audience. So early on, Dave Wiemers and Ken Koontz were a writing team, and they pitched Miami Mice based on Miami Vice. They said, no, it'll be after Cheese. It'll be great. I mean, just that title. And then that changed to Metro Mice. And I think Carl Gears and Jim Magan and myself actually wrote a pilot script, the villain of who, and the two mice were basically in a rodent police station. I mean, it was very much Hill Street Blues, but with rodents. And the villain of the piece was Fat Cat. Same design, same character, you know, as he was used later. So that mutated into Rescue Rangers, and the lead of Rescue Rangers was recast as Chip and Dale, and it became Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers. But it started with that catchy title, and that happened a lot. Well, Jeffrey saw the episode 00 Duck, and he said, that's a great title. And he said, create a show called 00 Duck, but it can't be Launchpad. The point is to create a new character. So I felt like, okay, he's the boss. But I didn't think deeply enough about it. I just thought, well, it's going to be a James Bond parody show. And this is before Austin Powers and things that did parodies much better than I tried. anyway, it had the typical stuff of, you know, the Q type person, you know, the typical James Bond tropes, the gadgets and all of that. But I pitched it to Jeffrey, and Jeffrey said, this is just a James Bond parody. It's got no Disney heart. It's got no sense of family. All the things that I felt about it, too. So there's that split second where, yeah, I agree with that. Hey. Oh, he says, you do it over. So actually, I'm very lucky that he told me to do it over and not let's assign it to somebody else, which is the more typical thing. So that's when I took it seriously, dove in, started thinking about the team, meaning the agents that would help him, as more of an eccentric team. And I called in some guys who would eventually be story editors on the show. I mean, they were on staff working on other projects. And it was Dwayne Capizzi who came up with, because of the suit that 00 had been wearing, he said, it makes me think of the Green Hornet. Hmm. And that just clicked immediately in my head about the old pulp heroes, and especially, strangely enough, Doc Savage, who had a team of eccentric guys who were specialists. This guy knew chemistry. This was the diplomat. This guy was the radio communications guy. This guy was transportation. So it was like, okay, that can be like a Darkwing team. And Launchpad, strangely enough, I wrote it, and it was one of those things. It was so long ago. It's like, this doesn't sound like me at all. Launchpad was part of that team. And every once in a while in DuckTales, Launchpad was played very weirdly, where he felt he had to be the hero. He was trying to be a hero. So he had this role where he was the sidekick, and he was feeling like, this is wrong, I should be the lead guy, which to me now is very un-Launchpad. But that's where he came back in. It wasn't like a direct connection to the Double Duck episode. It was like, you know, he's one of the characters we had to play with, and that just seemed to fill a little spot. Anyway, it didn't really click until we had Goslin, which gave it the sense of family. And it's like, okay, it's a guy struggling to be a secret agent, and he's got this rambunctious little girl who's not going to stay at home. Later on, we referred to it as, what if Batman had a little girl who refused to stay at home, basically. That gave it the heart. That got it the go-ahead. We started developing. It started being sold, and we had little cloisonné pins of 00 Duck and all that. And they went to the, I forget what the name of the convention is, where you sell syndicated things, because the broadcast industry has changed. Anyway, at that point it was public. It was covered in, you know, Variety and the Hollywood Reporter. And that brought Cubby Broccoli, was the guy who owned the rights to all the James Bond films. And they informed Disney that, no, there are no such things as 00 agents. That was created by Ian Fleming, and we own all that stuff, and you can't have it. So
what year is this? When are we talking about? How far before the premiere of the show is this?
Approximately, I'm going to say less than 2 years.
Okay.
I'm going to say about a year of, I would think a year and a half, 2 years. I never remember year dates. So there are many times in my career at Disney that I should have kept a diary. And like when I was working with Ward Kimball for 9 months, you know, in a little tiny room. And it's like, I had kids. You don't go home and say, all right, kids, I have to write down the wonderful day I had. anyway, the once freed from that, I got to lean more to my taste, which was away from secret agents and more into superheroes. I mean, pulp heroes, yeah, but all, and, you know, I love The Shadow, that whole, the weed of crime bears bitter fruit. You know, what evil lurks in the hearts of men, only the shadow knows, became I am the terror that flaps in the night. I don't remember what the original phrase was that Darkwing used. And let me skip back, come back to that. What happened is we needed a new name for Darkwing Duck. and Gary Kreisel, head of the division, actually okayed a contest where the prize was $500. That's a 1990s money. anyway, that's a lot. And Gary was a pretty cheap guy. That's why they loved him. He ran the division as if it was his own money, and it was lean and mean and hugely successful. Anyway, people submitted all sorts of names, every D alliteration you can think of, Dangerous Duck, Dead Eye Duck, you know, Dippy Duck, whatever it was. And it was Alan Burnett who came up with the name Darkwing, which was kind of a forehead slap for me. It's like, I never thought of Nightwing, you know, and it's like, wing is right there in the name. anyway, I thought that was perfect, but I said, that's the name of the character he thinks he is. I want to add Duck to it, which makes it silly. So it's both sides of his superhero persona. So he became Darkwing Duck. And once we got into development, I had a new name. We had the secret agent stuff really shrank down to basically funding him. Then it was full on Silver Age comics. And this is before, not before the internet, but before the internet went visual, when it was just text. So you couldn't look up comic book covers, but I always half remembered them. And a lot of early Flash comics and Green Lantern comics, Batman, stuff like that. In the silliest era of Batman, you know, when he wore different color costumes or rainbow costume. Or, you know, Jimmy Olsen was turned into a giant turtle boy or elastic lad. I mean, it was just, Julius Schwartz was the editor at DC at the time, who was famous for coming up with crazy covers and then asking people to write toward them. And I basically said that to my story editors to say, pitch me the comic book cover, because animation's a visual medium. If you basically have a visual hook, then it's going to help our show. It's going to be visual at the very core. And we aren't religious about that, but I think it was a great sentiment and basically what we, you know, strove after most of the times. Anyway, getting back to I Am the Terror That Flaps in the Night, it was that thing where I said he should say this in every episode, which didn't quite hit, but I say you should always say Let's Get Dangerous, and of course it was always in the title song. And here's his catchphrase, but it wasn't goofy until the third script, I think it was, and it was a Tusker Nini story, actually. It might have been called Double Darkwings. Anyway, Launchpad had to take the place of Darkwing and masquerade as Darkwing, but he could never get the phrase right. So he said, I am the terror that flaps in the night. I am the road salt that rusts the underside of your car. And after that script, and I forget, I should look it up, who the story editor was on that. I said, that's hilarious. We have to give that to Darkwing. So we actually went back and rewrote the scripts we had in development before that. And that's one of the most notable, you know, other than Let's Get Dangerous, I think that's what everybody remembers about Darkwing. And it really came from, what a great idea. I don't want to leave it in this one script, which was kind of the tone of the show we wanted. I said, I want to take an old, like, Warner short subject, give it Disney heart, and make it 22 minutes long with a kind of a feature story to it, and that's what we hit for the most part, I think. At least people tell me we did.
It worked on me.
I only see what's wrong.
It worked on me because I would watch Darkwing Duck literally every morning before school. It was on one of the stations that we got at something like 7 o'clock in the morning every day. When it was in syndication. And so I would literally wake up to Darkwing Duck in my Darkwing Duck bed sheets every morning and then go to school and then talk about Darkwing Duck and amongst other characters like Ghostbusters and such.
Were you Darkwing for Halloween?
No, you know, that was something that I always wanted, but my mom made me a...
Think you're a big fan, but Frank and Gomez.
Yeah.
Who is the co-producer of the new DuckTales and the story editor. He was Darkwing Duck for Halloween 3 years in a row. He did a school paper on Darkwing Duck in grade school.
My little brother was negative.
That guy knows Darkwing and loves the character. Yeah, so when people say, oh, Darkwing was just in that little bit in DuckTales, it's like Frank posted a picture of himself in his Halloween costume. Yeah. He says, there's going to be more.
Yeah. No, you can tell. You can tell just from that one scene in Beware the Buddy System how much care and attention there is in just that, because it's almost like a whole episode of Darkwing Duck in a couple minutes, right? Like it kind
of. Oh, yeah. Well, that was Ben Ballesteri did the boards, and Ben loved Darkwing and then worked for me on one of my shows. A couple of my shows, probably, and I forget which ones. It would have must Aladdin or Hercules. Anyway, Ben's just a fantastic artist, and he has a just gorgeous animation style. And currently, he's one of the producers of Tangled, and he was that is a full time job. You know, that's a gorgeous show too, and it takes a lot of hard work to make it a gorgeous show. And they kind of approached him and said, we know you have no time to do this, but we at least wanted you to know it's happening. And it was like, I'll kill you if you do not give this to me, kind of an attitude. And Ben boarded that, and he added in the shush, all the Easter eggs that are in there, the shush billboard with Grizzlykov on it, the shush flag, I think, is in there. He designed the characters that are in there. And people say, why is Liquidator suddenly buff? Well, that's how Ben drew him. That's why. And the rat catcher was not supposed to be in there. He just threw that in the background. So he basically designed a new rat catcher, you know. So it was his love and, you know, played right to everything Frank wanted. And, you know, the execution of that was just fantastic, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Curtis, what do you got? What do you got next?
Can you speak to developing Darkwing's his alter ego in his home life?
My feeling on Darkwing's home life was an old show, back in the black and white days of television. One of the most popular shows was The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, which was a family sitcom. Famous later for producing Rick Nelson, who became a big rock and roll guy.
Right.
Anyway, you never knew what, and this was true of like Father Knows Best too. These are, you know, or even all the shows, even Leave It to Beaver. Dad came home. You didn't know where he was coming home from, unless there were like blue collar shows that, you know, oh, Ralph Cramden is a bus driver, you know, or this guy works in the sewers or whatever. It was just a thing with me. I said, no, I never want to say what Drake Mallard does for a living, because one, I don't care. I don't want to do a show about great Drake Mallard in the office. That's dumb. I just tell the guys, basically, people tune in for the guy in the cape. Let's get into the cape. And we, again, there are episodes that break that rule, but his home life, the most we did, and there's one character who was part of the pitch that early on I immediately knew we're not going to use this character. There's no place for him. And that was Tank Muddlefoot. Because we had this next door neighbors. And basically the reason for the next door neighbors is to complicate Darkwing's life. Darkwing's, as far as he's concerned, it's like Bruce Wayne and Batman. He is Batman. Bruce Wayne is the fake guy. That's kind of how Darkwing sees himself. Mm-hmm. Except suddenly he's got this little girl. He's got this family. He's got this launch pad. He's got, you know, and he's got neighbors who want to come and the friendliest neighbors in the world. And they want to bring over cookies and have backyard barbecues. And it's all gets in the way. I wanted Gosling to have this, you know, pal of Honker. And we came up with Tank with just the idea of that here's the bully who's mean to Honker. And, you know, and I'm talking before even writing scripts, while it was still being pitched. And at those days, I did the first pitch. And then from then on, like Gary Kreisel, the head of the division, would then learn the pitch. And he would do it throughout the company and to toy companies and syndicators and all of that. I said, there's no reason to have Tank because Tank is a complication on the kids' lives, but the kids are supposed to be a complication on Darkwing's lives. So we don't want the camera over there. We want it on Darkwing. And Gary said he always gets a laugh because just how he flipped over the card and when he says the name Tank, everybody laughed. So we kept him in, and then very soon he went with Richie Cunningham's older brother, just went upstairs and never saw him again. So that, I mean, that was kind of developing his home life there. And then very much the sense of family of Frank Angonis is the one who said, Ted, everybody knows there's no Darkwing, you know, without Goslin and Launchpad. It's the story of a father and a daughter and a Launchpad. and Bryce is great as a fan and a great writer. In that Adventures of the Buddy System episode, Launchpad is inspired by this character who never gives up. Darkwing never gives up. He comes back from being bashed and all of that. And I never thought of him in that terms. It's 100% accurate. But I always was thinking of him as an ego thing, but it, you know, as opposed to that drive that he had to be a hero, to do what's right and all of that. Other than that, again, the voice actors were so great. Jim Cummings doing Herb Muddlefoot, and Binky, and you know, you just wanted to use them more because they were so hilarious.
So sorry, I'm gonna jump in here because what you just talked about brings up a really important question that we've got you. So I have to try and get an answer. Whenever I watch the Darkly Dawns the Duck, I always ask the question of myself, like, where does Darkwing's funding come from? Because he lives in the bridge, right? He lives like at the top of the tower of the bridge, and then when he adopts Goslin, he just has a house. Like, there's no step in between, and then all of the gadgets and like the rat catcher and just all his setup, it sort of implies that Bruce Wayne sort of thing, but we never hear anything about money with Darkwing series.
There's a lot about Darkwing that drives modern fans crazy. Yeah. Because now comics are all about continuity and all that. I was very much in the Silver Age world. Your continuity was Lois suspects Clark is Superman. Jimmy is Superman's pal. They all work at the Daily Planet for Perry White. Mm-hmm. Lex Luthor was bald and pissed off at Superman because he lost his hair as a teenager. And that was it. You know, villains kept coming. You knew the Joker was Batman's villain, but you often did not learn how they broke out of jail or Arkham Asylum or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, they showed up because that was the interesting part of the story. So even though, and I always say, no, that's great because that let the fans create that story. I mean, years later when fans began writing fanfic and all that. Anyways, so my feeling was always, Darkwing was a freelance agent for Shush. Mm-hmm. And that, because remember, he started as 00. So they are basically funding everything. Because however it started, they saw, you know, the leftover Q stuff. It's like, well, here's an agent. He's useful to us. You know, he needs most mode of transportation. And, you know, that bicycle he's riding or whatever isn't going to do the job. So I think that was it. And you just figure that he was in these life and death situations. So he probably made some good money there.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe it was wise investments.
No, I mean, that's essentially confirmation of my own theory, which is, you know, once Shush starts coming into it, it was always like, well, that's who pays Darkwing. That's who he's working for. And that's kind of,
and there's no episode where he works for Shush the first time. There's an episode where he becomes a full-time Shush guy and Rizikov puts him through training or whatever. But it was, again, it was just part of that ecosystem. That's what we were going to do. That's why there's no origin story, or I should say there's like six origin stories of Darkwing Duck. I always say he's basically Batman. There is no story there. I don't want to kill his parents in front of him. He's not going to sit in his easy chair saying, I need a symbol that will strike terror into the hearts of men. And a duck crashes through the window and he goes, that's it. I shall become a duck. Oh, wait. It doesn't work. So it was, the pilot story was about, you know, Darkwing and Gosselin mm-hmm. and Launchpad for that matter. Mm-hmm. And then so the, again, there's like six origins of Darkwing. Fans tend to pick the one where Megavolt and Darkwing are both in high school together. It's because they like it the most, and it's the most modern in terms of, oh, that's the continuity that works for us. But, you know, had we gotten another season, there probably would have been another two or three origins.
So you worked with a few different animation studios who would do different episodes, right?
Yes.
What was your involvement? Because a lot of these ones, I know like some of them, like Glenn Kennedy, were in town, but some of them were overseas. Did you get to go?
Kennedy was not in town.
Oh, really?
Then, yeah, because I worked on Bob's Burgers much later, and one of the guys actually worked for Kennedy Studios back in Chicago, I think, and actually worked on Darkwing and had a drawing he had done, you know, that was actually on the air. We didn't, basically, that was we had to turn these out so quickly that we had to use several different studios. Mm-hmm. And Kennedy, coming off of Tiny Toons, just actually was, their animation was way too broad, didn't match the rest of the series. And we had, I mean, my favorite studio, and I only got like 8-7 studios, episodes out of them, was the Disney Australia. And they loved the show. It's just, they were very small when they started it out. And it drove me nuts that later on Bonkers and Goof Troop got like 22 episodes each. Oh, I want to do that. But yeah.
So did you have to, like, this is before the days of Skype conferences like we're doing right now. Like, did you have to go over there and do any supervision of the animation studios?
We had an overseas supervisor on the various shows. I begged off, I don't know why, because now it's just, I begged off of almost all the overseas trips where they would send, Alan Zaslav was my partner who would go over there. And Alan goes back to UPA Studios directing there. I think he, as a kid, you know, delivered coffee to Termite Terrace at Warner's lot. Anyway, I was always trying to get the show out and working on that. And the only time I went overseas later on was to the Australian studio, which fantastic. And that was on Aladdin, I'm thinking. And then later on went to Hong Kong and Shenzhen and, you know, for some of the later shows or direct to videos. But basically we had to design the shows to be done by remote control. It wasn't so much face to face. Alan did lots of phone calls. Each director would have, you know, calls that they would have questions. Usually it was to the overseas guy who, when he's getting ready to hand out the show over there, he would have a bunch of questions, get answers to them, and then he would hand it out. Mm. But you have to realize back then it wasn't digital. We literally sent, when we say we shipped a show, it literally shipped. And one episode was lost and actually had to be, you know, recopied and reconfigured. Whoa. And things redone and then, you know, sent again. So it was just a whole different thing. Plus they were shot on film. So they're, I'm sure Mr. Bedsheets here was doing crazy in like the Negaduck episodes where they painted Negaduck wrong.
Yep.
And now it was like, we're out of time. It's got to go on the air. Or we didn't catch that. And you would call retakes, you know, to correct mistakes. But if you called too many on the same scene, trying to get it perfect, it would start scratching the cell because the same cells were being put under the camera and all that. And they would get scratching and that would show up on the film. And you didn't have digital cleanup as you could today. Mm-hmm. So when I look at that Darkwing sequence in the new show, that's just breathtaking. Not only the staging that Ben did and the design and everything else is so great, But it just, the animation looks so good, because the new DuckTales is full animation. I mean, here and there a studio might use some flash, but it's fully animated. And there are, you know, I just shake my head when I see fans saying, like, well, the animation isn't as good. And so I point to things like the dragon in the first episode, mm-hmm. and things people said, did you see the acting of that scene? It's like, yeah, that's real animation. And we never got that kind of acting in the early show. Mm-hmm. And they actually have animators on staff and who will animate key scenes, you know, to keep that quality up.
That's amazing.
We never had that chance to do that much, but you had storyboards with lots of notes on them, exposure sheets that timing directors. I mean, I know animation, but it boggled my mind that basically guys would fill out exposure sheets with timing without drawings, or sometimes there'd be a little drawing that they would put in. But it's like, if you, I mean, animation is basically space over time, meaning if I'm going to jump, I'm going to squat down, and then there's going to be a stretch, and then I'm up in the air, and then I ball up at the top of the arc, and then stretch, and then land. That's an animated jump. Well, depending, you can do that timing, but it's really, if the animator only has that character squash down or squat down a little bit, then that's not going to be as punchy. If he doesn't stretch out the same, or if he makes the jump shorter, it's still the same, quote, timing, but it'll look terrible because the drawings aren't as extreme as we assumed they would be, or too extreme. So it was just, it's ultimately a very frustrating thing. So the idea that now digitally you can correct all the mistakes, you don't have dust, you don't have scratches, and if something's really bad, you have a technical director in the studio who can fix things, that you can actually make a correction in one afternoon.
Well,
it's right because you're looking at it, and then that gets cut in the show.
Wow.
But like we had, when we were doing Gummy Bears, I remember we finished a show on Thursday, editing and final sound and all that, to be shown that Saturday morning.
What?
Close it was to getting on the air. And
that's crazy.
Wow. Yes, it was.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the voice actors that you use? Did you get say in the casting?
Yeah, I mean, the casting director on Darkwing was Ginny McSwain. Jim Cummings calls her Darkwing's mom, not Darkwing's dad, because they really worked on that, creating that character. First, there's a natural thing that once writers hear a voice, they can then start writing to it, and the actor ad-libs certain things. They say, oh, that's a good thing. We can repeat that, or something similar to that. Or, oh, we like how he's snarky. We can use that, you know. So you get that kind of feedback. But right there in the booth, specifically, I remember Jim had, obviously, Darkwing got smashed a lot. Excuse me. He did this flattened voice. And which, if you hear it, is very Darkwing. But then it was just a voice he did at one point. And then I remember the following week's episode, or maybe the one after that, again, he was flattened, and it was, and Jim did a sound. And then Ginny said, no, do that flattened sound. You remember we did it there? And so they were constantly feeding back. Jim would do something, Ginny would remember it, feed it back to him, and it became part of Darkwing's way of doing things. And again, the writers could write to that, you know, hear how he does it. So the Jim Cummings, I just loved working with. I first worked with him, I guess, on Gummies. Yeah, because he took over for Paul Winchell's voices. You know, he was Fat Cat. We used him a lot on Rescue Rangers, and then he became Monterey Jack, too. So, I mean, Rescue Rangers had half the time I recorded with just four people, because Jim Cummings does a billion voices, Corey Burton does a billion voices, and Tres McNeil does a billion voices. So, you know, we barely need, just for spice, we would add in a fourth guy. So I knew Jim from then. He's a super nice guy. I don't remember. I mean, we listened to other voices, but I had Jim in mind. I didn't have a voice in mind. I had Jim as a talent in mind. Hmm. And this is something, I mean, it's a whole different world now because you're casting actors, not just voice actors. You're acting, you know, actors from television shows and things like that. They bring, you know, a certain thing to show. So when they're casting the new DuckTales, they'll say, oh, this character's like that guy from Parks and Rec would be perfect on him, or that guy from whatever, you know, show on. And then they have him in along with other people in that range, and they decide on who's right for it. In the old days, when we were almost all voice actors, if you really trusted the actor, and this didn't happen a lot, but I'm pretty sure that's how I did Darkwing, although we were never to say, oh, here's the one voice. You know, everybody needed to hear a bunch of choices. But you let the actor discover a voice. They try things and they tweak it and all that. And it's like, ideally, if you have talented people, they do that in the audition. Other times, people just come in, they have to do a take, and that's kind of it. So anyway, I know I wanted Jim. Goslin was, I'm sure we just did a lot of voices, and Chrissy was just, you're always looking with a kid's voice with something unique to give them a special flavor, and sometimes it's a lisp or it's a accent, and Chrissy, that was her voice. Who, and of course, she later did Chucky on Rugrats. Mm-hmm. She was just a delight. She was so perfect. And her reads were so strange. And that became Goslin. And Terry McGovern was already Launchpad. And even though we recreated Launchpad and suddenly beefed him up, and instead of being a smart guy who's a bad pilot, we made him a great pilot, but an incredibly stupid guy. I would tease Frank, because Frank then made him even dumber and a bad pilot. You know. I love the episode of the new show where basically Launchpad is going to a secret base via submarine, and he says, oh, no, I know it's supposed to be secret, so he blindfolds himself. And the one time they almost crash is because the blindfold slipped and he actually saw where he was going. So, sorry, I'll readjust, you know. That's just a whole different level. So, I mean, that was the core cast. And then Steelbeak was based on a voice I knew that Rob Paulsen did, because Rob would kid around in that voice, and I said, I'm gonna remember that, I want to use you. And that was fine. So because once you get out of the main characters where you have to play for a bunch of people and people get to weigh in on, just episode wise you know, I had the final say. So, and a lot of those voices are just working with Ginny, and she would say, so-and-so would do this, you know, or I have this guy coming in, and I could veto somebody, but unless, and there were times when people came in, they did something different than what I had in my head. But as long as it was good in a different way, that's fine. Cause I was a production oriented guy, which well, I was popular with management. And there are times I wish I had held out for something specific I wanted. This came up actually today on another podcast. If there's a villain I liked, especially if an actor did it and I say, oh, I really like that, I would encourage people to use them. Or I'd brainstorm, it would just be natural that I would have ideas for that character myself. If I didn't like a character, or if the actor came out and I said, I'm not necessarily feeling it, I wouldn't push it, but if it inspired one of my story editors, I wouldn't get in their way and say, oh, don't use them, you know. So that's, you know, I just, my feeling is you put a great crew together and then let them do their job. It doesn't mean you don't direct them. You don't tell them where you want things to go, but you let them bring their interpretation to it. One of my story editors, I remember I always was like, beating them up, because the thing you don't want to do to an actor is give them a line read. And it's like, no, we're paying that guy the money who has a huge acting background, not your standard thing. Yes, I know that reading was in your head as you wrote it, but let's see what comes naturally from this guy. You let the people do their job. And that was fun. I mean, to me, that was the joy of creating these shows. It was having these super talented people, both the cast and the crew. And just, you know, I always say I know enough about all the jobs to be dangerous, but it's really, you want people to take your idea and really surprise you, you know, with it.
When you first did, when you were first developing the show as Double O Duck, did you have the comedy bend to it right off the bat? Because traditionally, yeah.
I mean, it came from a DuckTales inspiration. And yeah. Even though there's been much talk about double universes, in the first page of the Bible, it does say a spinoff of DuckTales. And that's because DuckTales was a huge success. And of course, you're going to call it a spinoff of DuckTales.
Yeah.
But it was always supposed to be comedy adventure. And most of the Disney shows were. It was just where on that comedy adventure spectrum you are.
Darkwing is way serious.
It's like Gargoyles, but there's still gags in there. There's still, you know, the Gargoyle's personality lent a funny situation. So that was always part of it.
But this one was much more of a slapstick kind of humor as well. Like, if you watch DuckTales, the original one, it's way more of a serious adventure show with funny bits in it. But
yeah, there were different teams. Ted Anasty and Patsy Cameron were like the lead story editors until Jim Magon came on. And basically Jim did the most Carl Bark stories, I felt, and did the multi-parters. And then Ted and Patsy brought humor to it. And then Ken Kuntz, David Wiemers, they brought a different kind of more dialogue comedy, I think, to things, but also caught that adventure. But again, I said the tone I was going through with Darkwing is this is a short subject temperament that you stretch out, give heart to. That's the goal I was after.
Yeah.
And again, there are things that kind of I never meant. I was trying to explain to people, I say, no, Darkwing, this is the kind of show where he can reach out a frame and then bring back in a hammer if he needs it, you know. And it came back in that whole, for my personal taste, I would have said, no, let's redo that. But again, it was like guys would do that gag. But the problem was the storyboard guys, instead of having it up close, like, I'm sure this doesn't help your podcast audience, but like you're seeing me right now, reach out, bring something back in. But if they storyboard him like this, to reach out of the scene, his arm has to stretch.
Right, right.
It's more of a Chuck Jones guys than a Bob Clampett kind of guy who was in the early days of Warner Brothers, was more stretchy. And when I saw that, my reaction was, but then, well, I guess that's a part of Darkwing now, that he do those stretchier things. I remember there was a scene where... it was Megavolt, I want to say Megavolt and Quackerjack had Darkwing in like a dentist chair to torture him or something. And I always saw that as like a real dentist's office, which were kind of compact places. And, you know, in the script it says, you know, Megavolt reaches over to flip the light switch. The layout guy drew this big giant in a room that was very dramatic and a lot of open floor space. And I'm sure I okayed that layout without thinking of the specific gag. But I remember people saying, like, how's he supposed to get over there to turn the light switch? I'm just like, and the solution was basically not necessarily literally for that episode, was they can move really fast. So you can do it, you know, come back in. So again, that the show did develop itself by playing to what was there, and I always tried to say, if it's funny and entertaining, let's leave it in, even if I would prefer to do a different funny thing. Whereas nowadays, I think it's more about let's fine-tune this thing, get everybody on the same, you know, beam, and really, you know, make the shows hit a certain mark every scene almost. I'm in awe of the new stuff.
Well, do you want to talk about the new show a little bit?
It's amazing that I've talked so little about the new show. Usually, yeah. In panels too, it's just like I suddenly start talking about that because
you're obviously
guys
a fan.
I'm super impressed with what the guys have done, and I remember Sean Jimenez, who I think this is the last name. Anyway, Sean, the art director, gave a presentation where he's basically got a blank screen that he's talking about. And what he's talking about is they wanted to include the feeling of the comics into the show. Sean took it to the degree of looking at the texture of the pulp newsprint that books were printed on. Mm-hmm. So every shot of DuckTales has a very faint overlay of that texture. Yeah. That's the Zippitone that's in the shadows of the backgrounds too. So when you're talking about that little of love and detail about actually getting the pulp print, you know, as part of your graphic design, that's just amazing to me, you know. And story-wise, the guys have just knocked it out of the park, and they said, because, you know, it's a very small writer's room they have. It's like 5 people. And they said, well, how big was your writer's room? I said, we didn't have a writer's room. What are you talking about? We'd like talk everything. People would talk to me, and the writer would go away and come up with something. And then the story editor would rewrite it constantly, and it would come to me, and I'd give notes. And the idea of breaking a story or a season, it was just like total form. I wish you had done stuff like that. It was just a foreign way of working. And we, you know, our schedule was painful.
So we are recording this, and the season finale of season 1 hasn't aired yet. But so far, what is your favorite episode of this new DuckTales?
I don't know. There's a lot. I mean, I just really love them all, especially after the hiatus. They really started hitting some great ones. The golf show was great. just that sense of magic. It almost felt like there was a feature sensibility to it. You know, of course, I love the Darkwing and Gizmo Duck episode. Again, because that was probably the most character exploration of Launchpad that's ever been done on him. and just to tie it to Darkwing like that was just... you know, brilliant. The Gladstone Gander was always a favorite character of mine. That episode was great and visually so fantastic, where Donald has to go on through the maze and have a race with Gladstone. I think they're just all good to me. I can't think back to the originals or the early episodes, but I don't know. I just love everything about them. I'm paying attention to them. And really, as they play out their season arc, where you know that Lena, this best friend of only friend, really, of Webby, has got this deep secret. And a few episodes back, she had that nightmarish sequence where she destroys Webby. It was just like, how do you do that? Oh, I love that. Speaking of destroying women, I love the Goldie episode. Mm-hmm. She falls in the lava, and it was like whoa! And it was like I was like a couple of beats ahead. I went, oh yeah, wait a minute, she had that amulet kind of thing. But still, that was just so great, and the tension between those characters, and yet real affection was. I mean, that was just some fantastic writing and performances to pull off that relationship at the heart. I don't know if that was like necessarily the favorite show of young kids. I think it was still full of adventure and treachery and twists and turns. So I think it would be fine, but it was a sophisticated on a whole different level.
Yeah.
And she leaves him a note with a photograph to say, if you want to, you know, have another adventure with me, you know, that was just great. You know, it really gave Scrooge such a sense of heart. I mean, the main thing on the new DuckTales is And I try to, and now most people are over it. Every once in a while I post something, you get someone says, no, I like the first ones better. Like, because you were eight when you loved them, and it's, you know, I get that. But when you're doing a new show and people say, well, why isn't, you know, Jim Cummings doing the voice of John Carnage? And this is a different relationship. So-and-so was never like that, or Gizmo wasn't that way, or... it's like if you're going to do a new Robin Hood show or James Bond, you don't every Sean Connery James Bond had its own continuity. And every Daniel Craig James Bond has its own continuity, which goes back and reinterprets some of that same material. Mm-hmm. But there's not a continuity between them. It's a reboot. It's, you know, and every time there's a new Bond guy, it's a new, you know, some stuff is carried over, but it's got a continuity within it. Same with Sherlock Holmes. You don't go back to the last Sherlock Holmes series. You go back to the books. You go back to the source material. Yet, you might save things like the Deerstalker hat, which is not in the Holmes books. That was actually brought out in the radio show or the play, actually. I think the early Sherlock Holmes play that was done. And yet, we always think of that as, mm-hmm. you know, part of Sherlock Holmes. So that's what DuckTales did, except the source material of DuckTales is not the old DuckTales. It is the old DuckTales plus Donald Duck short subjects, plus Donald Duck comics, plus all the Carl Bark stuff, plus the Don Rosa stuff, plus the comic strips. Frank and Matt know all that stuff. And they didn't. They pick and choose from all that stuff to create their world. And the entire, as people are now learning, the entire Disney Afternoon is part of the source material as far as they're concerned. Mm-hmm. So Frank told me early on, he said, basically, it was like, how much of the Disney Afternoon can we have? And the response was, all of it, except for Chip and Dale, because they have a movie in development, supposedly. Frank keeps asking. what I say to people about... when they see, and now you've seen Don Carnage, but when they mention Cape Suzette, people talk about Easter eggs. Well, those aren't Easter eggs. They're breadcrumbs. Part of the universe. Yeah. And sooner or later, you're going to see that. And some of those crumbs, you're not going to pick up until season two.
Yeah.
You know, or three or four or five, you know, whatever. But those guys never do anything lightly. They never just say, oh, here's a Darkwing Duck. We're going to do a minute of Darkwing Duck. And we're done. Like, no, that's a thing of Darkwing Duck. There's a million ways you can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, take him farther. You could have, I saw some people just going through a bunch of theories of, Launchpad could have dreams about Darkwing Duck. And you could get a whole series of Darkwing dreams, you know. Or somebody gets hit on the head and they imagine themselves having a Darkwing Duck adventure. Or... you watch episodes of the old TV show and you do that thing where somebody's watching a TV show and then somebody else is having an adventure and is mirroring what's in the TV show. You could do that sort of stuff, you know. I'm sure the kid who was Darkwing Duck for three Halloweens, I assume in a row, who did a school report on Darkwing Duck, I'm sure he's going to find ways to do Darkwing. And, you know, I hope so. I see it. But as I caution people, I say, it is DuckTales. It's not Darkwing Duck. So when they do stuff like that, it's always going to be a gag or running gag or hopefully a secondary plot or a reference and stuff like that. So
my hope is that they do
stuff.
They do something where Launchpad meets Jim Starling and they have an adventure, right? And Launchpad thinks like, oh, I get to team up with Darkwing, and we get all the callback to Darkly Dawns the Duck, where he's like, oh, I'm your biggest fan. I've even built this airplane, and like we get like stuff like that.
Well, I mean, that is the thing right now, is he is Darkwing's biggest fan.
Yeah.
You see it from his posters and the bobblehead that everybody wants.
Yeah.
his board. I thought that was brilliant how they did that they took the idea of he's his biggest fan and just made it mean something in a different way. I hope we get to see more, you know, Darkwing. And it was, they were very thrilled And Frank let me know, and now it's no longer a secret because it's in stores, that Darkwing was part of the toy pack.
Yeah.
That hidden, he's one of the chase figures, you know, and it's like, that's fantastic. And they said, look, it's our Darkwing. you know, that's just exciting for me that, that the fans have that much love. And people within the company, again, now you're getting people who watch the shows are now old enough to be working the company and now in middle management and are moving up. Yeah, they were super excited to find out that Gizmo Duck and Darkwing were going to pop up in DuckTales.
It's funny because there's more there are more Darkwing Duck action figures that have come out in the last year than there were when I was a kid, when the show was on. And it's like when the show was on, it was like I think there was a Darkwing Duck in a cereal box, and then there was the action figure with the spinning hat. And I think as far as I knew as a kid, that was it. Like that was you know. And now it's like, oh,
Australia evidently got Happy Meal toys that we didn't get in the States.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then here and there, there's Darkwing figures and or coin banks or night lights and things like that. But no, the Funko stuff is fantastic.
Yeah.
And generally, I do not. My feeling is I don't give Disney money to buy characters I created. And basically I'm spoiled from that deal I made. But Amy Meberson, who created Disney Pocket Princesses online, and is now actually has designed a toy line for Hasbro
first. Yeah, it looks super good.
But she gave me the Funko Darkwing Goslin, and I had to get the Negaducks for that. Oh, and she gave me the Launchpad too. So they're just too good to pass up. But if strangely enough, even though as much on model it is, it's like, no, I don't need the other action figure. Although I'm tempted that the little minifigure Goslin is perfect size relationship to the action figure.
Yes, it is.
But it's like, you know, in a short period of time, we moved a lot because we were like renting houses while we were looking to buy this house ultimately. But people kept selling houses out from under us, and we kept on having to move. And once you move that many times, you kind of get over the whole, let's collect a bunch of action figures and stuff and things like that, because you got to pack them up, and every time you do, they get broken or whatever. But no, I'm thrilled that it's part of it. And again, I hope that, you know, I mean, everybody has their favorite. I mean, people want a Tailspin show and all that. I don't think they're going to resurrect the entire Disney Afternoon line. But I think you're going to see bits and pieces as we watch DuckTales, because it's Tales of the Duck Family, which now, you know, encompasses Launchpad and Gizmo will get some episodes, already has had two, and you know, I can't wait to see where they go with this stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, man.
I doubt that Lightyear will show up, but it's Pixar thing there. But and there's always that debate of, well, when did the Disney Afternoon end? Because everybody said, well, this is the Disney Afternoon for real. And this is the later Disney Afternoon or whatever.
Well, why don't you tell us about some upcoming conventions that you have?
I have one in, depending on when you put this out, I have one coming up in, 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, Dragon Con in Atlanta, which was my favorite convention of last year, because I'm quite aware of the nostalgia window, which right now Atlanta has a little older fan base, and they are in the sweet spot of people old enough to remember the show, be fans of the shows, and have a little bit of disposable income. Because when I basically only go to shows, I get a lot of comments online. Will you come to such and such show? It's like, well, if they invite me, because I just do it for fun. In that, again, Ron Clemens can go to the movies and hear an audience react to Moana. We were doing these shows, and yeah, we had this abstract, you know, Nielsen numbers and told it was a hit and we got to do more episodes, but you never got a fan reaction until now, 25 years later. I'm having people crying, you know, in front of my table. Because all my characters are owned by Disney, I can't really make prints of them or sketchbooks of them to sell. So before the conventions, I just create a lot of original artwork to sell at cons. You know, I put higher prices on them because people told me to, and it's like, people buy them, so who am I to say no? But that's so I have something at the table to talk to people and all of that. I have a super fun, and then the cosplay that comes up of Gadget or Chip and Dale and Darkwing. It's just always a lot of fun to see, and really just people who really love the show and what it meant. The relationship of Darkwing and Goslin was huge in ways we didn't understand when we were doing it, but we consciously made them hug each other and no matter what, they loved each other. You know, they could have fights and be exasperated. And that, turns out, was hugely important to people with, like, broken homes or semi-broken homes. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of heartbreaking to hear that. But it was like, you know, they're thanking me. And it's like me and the crew and all the guys in development that helped create that. Mike Peraza is a fantastic artist. And he's the one who put Darkwing in the bridge. I'm pretty sure he did the basic silhouette of St. Canard, too, that City on the Hill kind of thing. And he did a lot of work early on, and you know, I would design a foul thing and he'd computerize it and turn it into stuff. But Bob Klein was another artist who did a lot of the early pitch art and stuff like that. And just this, I had such a great time doing that. You know, I'm excited now that here's all these people who were inspired by that. And it's fantastic now talking to visiting the guys at TV Animation, because recently they redecorated the offices, and here are silhouettes or model sheets of our shows now part of the wallpaper that's there. Probably seen some of it online.
Yep.
And what people don't understand is, like, we were the black sheep of the studio. We were hugely successful, but we weren't features. Features, you know, was the thing that made Disney Animation. We were this thing on the side, and some of the people at Disney Features really didn't want us to exist. Whereas Michael Eisner felt like, he said that at the very first meeting, Disney is the top name in animation. Everywhere there's animation, Disney should be there. That doesn't mean Disney TV has to look like Disney Features or Disney commercials, which you never really got into, has to look as good as either one of those, or it can look different, or can have different design choices or whatever. But Disney should be part of that. Hmm. But now it's like, and part of it is the aging of people who now run the company. There was even some resistance saying, no, it should be all new stuff. And they say, no, this is the heritage. And guys are coming in now that were inspired by these shows that are now on the walls, and then it goes through the years, and here's the new show, here's the new version of that character. That just makes me feel good, you know, to go back and see all that stuff and see the excitement, and to be sincerely enthused with, you know, stuff they're doing. And, you know, my old partners, Bob Squillion, Mark McCorkle, who created Kim Possible, are currently on Big Hero 6. And they, you know, that's another great show that's going on right now. And Dana Terrace, who was storyboarding on Gravity Falls, was an early director on DuckTales, has now got her own show in development called, I want to say, Owl House. Everything I see, it's like, yeah, that's the show I would want to work on. You know, so it's just exciting what's going on there.
It is, yeah.
All started with a duck. Or a bear. A bouncing bear, I guess, technically. Or a puzzle.
Mike, do you have any more questions?
No, you know,
any
I
more
think
mysteries you have to solve.
I know. Yeah,
I was in a red inside of his cape.
You satisfactorily answered the gnawing questions that I had in the back of my mind. So it's like, okay, now I can rest. I'm gonna sleep so well tonight. It's gonna be great.
In your DuckTales bedsheets.
Yeah. I do still have the pillowcase and the comforter from that set. And when my daughter gets a little bit older, they'll go on her bed.
Both the Rescue Rangers sheet and the Darkwing sheet. And you know, when you go to a convention, there's the conceit where, you know, on good days, you cover your stuff when you're away from the table, mm-hmm. or overnight, you just put a cover over it. And I use those sheets to cover up my table, which is one of those things where, I don't know, to a collector, those sheets actually might be what's underneath it.
they'll take it in the middle of the night.
Yeah, so actually, going back to conventions, I've only got two conventions. One I haven't been officially announced. I think August 13th I'll be announced for a convention in Europe. But other than that, it's just Dragon Con. So if anybody anywhere near southeastern mm-hmm. United States, make the trip. It's a fantastic convention. Look it up online. I mean, look for videos. There is a parade that goes through town. That's how big the convention is, in that it's a costume parade that goes on for, I'm sure, more than an hour. And they divide it up over 5 hotels. So it is, and each hotel has programming and sales and things like that. And then there's a 6th place where all the comic artists and Artist Alley and all of that is in. And now, I spoiled last year. Everybody was amazed at the weather because it was cooler and, I mean, it's still hot, but and drier. Whereas Atlanta's not known for that. So I don't know what it'll be in a couple of weeks. But I hope to see people there. So please come out and say hi.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, I think that's it from me. Thank you so much for giving us this time today to talk about Darkwing and about everything that you've worked on. It's a huge honor for me. I know Curtis shares that sentiment to get to talk to you, because this is formative stuff. And Darkwing's character literally informed the way that I interact with people. I know there's a lot of his snarkiness that's in my DNA. Just
clouds and things like that.
Yeah. I always enter rooms in a cloud of gas. So I hear that,
but you know, there's probably pills or something you could take for that. Back on the garlic or carbonated beverages.
So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It was my pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the podcast. That is probably the biggest honor, because I've done interviews before on other podcasts, but the people that I've interviewed, they don't listen to the podcast. Maybe they listen to the episode that they were in to make sure that they didn't say anything that they shouldn't have, but they don't listen to like the episode recaps. And so the fact that you're listening and then talking to us on Twitter just means so, so much. So thank you for hearing
all you guys making guesses about stuff. That's like a clue. That's not true at all.
Whoops. Uh-oh.
I should have written some of those down. Actually, there was a couple you did recently, but
I'm sure we're wrong all the time. We're pretty good.
Well, that's the fun part of this is speculating
exactly.
And
makes
stuff.
It fun, and then you see what actually happens on the show, things like that. But the behind the scenes speculation about what people were thinking of when they did something has always been, you know, part of it. And it's just like we used to say, because people would say, "Oh, Disney, it's synergy, and they work this, and they were making sure people read this and watch that." And we would always go, "We wish Disney was that connected." You know, it was like, we can't get people to pay attention to anything. Where people have these big conspiracy theories, you know, about stuff. And here, sometimes it's, you know, with the new DuckTales show, it's hard not to do a deep dive. If speculation, because half of it is true, more than half. I mean, I pointed out recently that online that in a recent episode, I guess it was the Don Carnage episode, and Don Carnage calls his pirates UB players, you know, because they did such a terrible job. And I pointed out that that's an Easter egg in that Jim Meng and Mark Zasloff created a show called B Players about the sidekicks of all the movies, like Baloo and some new characters they did, and basically the odd jobs they took between their movies. And they pitched that over and over to the point where I think Jeffrey Katzenberg threatened Jim's life if he ever pitched it again. But that made the guys familiar with the Jungle Book characters, and that ultimately turned into Tailspin. So having Don Carnage call the guys B players was an intentional thing. And it's like, nice. Frank was very proud. He does Easter eggs of shows that didn't even exist. And the main thing, well, here, that's the thing. He really challenged people. At San Diego, I guess, he said, there are Easter eggs people have not caught from the first season, from the first half of the first season, even. He says, people have not gotten them all. So there you go. While you're waiting for the second season, you can re-go everything. Frame it on.
That's amazing.
But it's been great. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, maybe we'll call on you again to get a little bit. We'll talk about the other shows that we didn't talk about, and maybe not talk about Darkwing Duck.
Fine. Yeah, there's. Yeah. I mean, again, yeah, there was Aladdin, Hercules, Team Atlantis is actually we're doing a panel. Henry Gilroy and I, Henry, who's on Star Wars Rebels, he actually pitched the idea of the two of us talking about the show that never was, which was the spinoff of the Atlantis movie. And then of course I left Disney, did a couple of Hellboy movies. I did Brother Rabbit for Universal. I did a show for Netflix. I was on Bob's Burgers. There was like crazy time. So
yeah, lots to talk about. Yeah. Wow.
Get that awesome. Non-Disney dad show. That's what you'll.
Okay. Well, it's bedtime here at my house and I can hear my daughter crying, so I should probably help my wife.
Hate for it if you don't.
Yep. But thank you so much. We really appreciate this, Ted.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest DuckTales news by heading to cartoonafternoon.com, where you'll find everything DuckTales and Disney cartoon related for the shows that we cover. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/tuneafternoon, as well as on Twitter at tuneafternoon. And if you want to send us an email, you can do that by sending us an email at tuneafternoon@gmail.com.
You can also find us on Twitter. You can find me at Curtis Findlay, KurtisFindlay.
And I'm on Twitter at ArkWulf, ArkWulf. And don't forget that we are part of the Thunderquack Podcast Network. Head to thunderquack.com to check out all the other great podcasts in our network. And if you want to support us, you can do that two ways. First, by heading to store.thunderquack.com to pick up some merch. Or you can head to patreon.com/thunderquack and pledge your support over there. It's a monthly pledge. As low as $1 a month gets you access to the exclusive Thunderquack podcast, as well as the Thunderquack Patreon Facebook group. So that's patreon.com/thunderquack. And thank you to everybody who does support us over there.
Disney Dad's Cartoon Afternoon is not associated with the Disney Company in any way. All characters, titles, music, and everything is all copyright of their respective owners. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Disney Dad's Cartoon Afternoon.